From our WPR Bureau in Superior, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a sexual harassment investigation at UW-Whitewater that was released through an open records request last week. This is the second sexual harassment investigation into Alan Hill, also known as Pete Hill, who is the husband of former UW-Whitewater Chancellor Beverly Copper. She resigned from her post in December following the UW system's investigation. Do you work in the UW system or in higher ed? What do you think of these allegations? How have these reports affected your work environment? Perhaps you're a lawyer who works on sexual harassment cases. What have you found to be difficult about these cases? How hard is it to prove harassment of any kind? Share your perspective, your questions, 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer is a higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she's been reporting on the UW-Whitewater investigation for the past 8 months. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about the women making these allegations after the release of these documents? Who are they?
That's a good question. They haven't released many of the names since they are victims of sexual harassment. They've redacted their names. We do know that there were potentially up to 10, at least 7 women who are making claims against Mr. Hill. Some were students. Some were former employees at UW-Whitewater, some may be current employees, but a lot of the information about these women are redacted in the report.
And we learned through the report that some of these women were hesitant to come forward or reluctant because they didn't want to tarnish the chancellor's office?
Yeah, in a few cases, some of the women were working within the chancellor's office, so they feared that they could lose their job over this. A lot of the women sort of acknowledged that this was sort of a very difficult situation with the chancellor being the woman and their alleged harasser being her husband. So they wanted to tread lightly, and they didn't know if they were, you know, making it up in their head or not.
And this sexual harassment investigation was conducted last September and completed in December. How were these allegations first reported?
Well, there were actually at least 2 previous investigations into the behavior of Mr. Hill. One that was done in 2017 was found to be unsubstantiated, and the other was done in like the first half of 2018, and that one was found to have merit. It had 2 women making complaints against Mr. Hill. And that second investigation in early 2018 led to him being banned from campus last summer and stripped of his unpaid ceremonial title as associate to the chancellor. So that happened last June, and in September is when media reported on this banning and it became public, which led to more women coming forward with allegations against him. So the UW system, which oversees UW-Whitewater and other UW campuses, they opened another investigation looking not only into these additional allegations, but also into to what extent Dr. Copper knew of what was going on and, you know, injected herself into the investigation or not.
What did investigators find as they conducted their interviews as far as evidence is concerned?
Well, they found that, you know, there were a large number of complaints suggesting his behavior toward women was, in the report quotes, pervasive and well known. They wrote that some employees took steps to protect one another from him. But they also found that they found no evidence that Dr. Copper interfered with the investigation and that she did not retaliate against women who claimed that her husband had harassed them. However, the reporters did note that she accepted her husband's denial and then took no further steps to inform herself about the additional allegations. And the report said that she found that the grudges being lodged against him were really aimed at her for personal reasons.
We're talking with Kelly Meyerhofer. She's the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever dealt with sexual harassment in the workplace? How did you deal with it? And what can you tell people who are reluctant to come forward? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly, many of those who did come forward weren't victims themselves. They were second-hand sources, witnesses, or people who had heard about Hill's alleged behavior. What have the attorneys involved in the case said about this and secondhand sources?
Right. So there were about 28 people, if I remember correctly, that investigators interviewed for this latest report that was released last week. Copper's attorney, who specializes in representing higher education leaders, chancellors, boards of regents, stuff like that, he said he's never seen someone fired based on a report that is filled with rampant speculation, and it's based on secondhand or anonymous sources. So for some of the women, you know, they declined to be interviewed by the investigators, so the report in those cases relies on others who say they were told of the harassment by the women and were passing it along to the investigators. And Copper's attorney, you know, in his written response that was sent to us, said that if Dr. Copper had looked into the issue further, it would have been perceived as interfering with the investigation.
The UW system, this was an independent investigation. So Who was behind the investigation? Who was looking into this?
There were two investigators. One was a retired FBI agent. The other, I'm not too sure of his background, but they were working for a firm called Hurley Burrish SC. There was an invoice included in the records release that they were paid about $47,500, or this firm was.
Have we heard from the UW system or from the former chancellor on this investigation?
The UW system's response is that, you know, President Ray Cross, when he first learned of these allegations, he acted immediately. When more women came forward, he opened another investigation, and the UW system takes sexual harassment seriously. Dr. Copper's attorney, his response is that the report is, again, rampant with speculation, and she should not have been forced to resign over this.
So now that this investigation is over, it's closed, how is this affecting the former chancellor of UW-Whitewater?
Yeah, well, she had tendered her resignation in December, shortly after this investigation concluded. There's some suggestion that she was forced out and did not really offer the resignation willingly. She does have, per the terms of her contract, she's going to keep a tenured professorship in her area of study, which is psychology. So she will be back. She can come back to campus at a reduced salary and be teaching psychology courses in the fall. It's unclear, you know, whether she will be doing that or not. She submitted a work plan outlining sort of what she'll be doing with those courses, but she, you know, has not confirmed, and her lawyer has not confirmed to me that she will be back next fall.
We're talking about the UW-Whitewater sexual harassment investigation and the report released last week. It found the husband of the former UW-Whitewater chancellor had sexually harassed at least 7 women. We're talking about it with Kelly Meyerhofer. She's the higher ed reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Whose responsibility is it to prevent sexual harassment? What kind of obligations do colleges have to people on campus? How have you seen your school handle sexual harassment claims? You can call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this discussion in a minute on the Ideas Network.
Yeah.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a recent UW system investigation that found evidence that the husband of the former UW Whitewater chancellor sexually harassed at least seven women. The UW system released its completed independent investigation last week, and it claims that Pete Hill, the husband of former UW Whitewater chancellor Beverly Copper, sexually harassed students or employees at the university. Where do you see opportunity to make universities safer, to make campuses safer? What regulations do you think could help prevent sexual assault or compel people to stop inappropriate behavior? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly Meyerhofer is the Wisconsin State Journal's higher education reporter. Kelly, let's go back to that previous investigation that led Pete Hill to being banned from campus last June. How was that investigation different from what we just saw released last Friday?
That's a good question. In that other investigation that led to him being banned from campus, they found three instances of inappropriate contact. The first was like a full body hug that the woman described as lasting too long. A woman reported that he invaded her body space in a conference room when he allegedly leaned in for a kiss on the mouth. A lot of what other women interviewed in the most recent investigation, they described similar sorts of accounts of inappropriate touching or comments that made them feel uncomfortable. But this investigation also kind of went a bit further into looking at whether Dr. Copper, the chancellor, knew about these allegations and whether she did anything to stop them. It also looked a lot into the campus culture and her leadership ability. Investigators interviewed former and current employees and found several people had issues with her management style and her lack of budgetary understanding. Copper's attorney, in his response, said that the report essentially resorts to a performance evaluation in which Copper was not provided a chance to respond to, and it went outside of the investigation's scope.
So there was also intertwined here her leadership abilities. That sounds like this investigation also kind of had some insights on as well.
Yeah, there were a lot of questions asked about her workplace performance. And if you look at the charging statement that the UW system gave to the investigators, they weren't really supposed to be looking into that. And that's one of the major critiques that Dr. Copper and her attorney have, was that they didn't know that this was part of the investigation and they weren't really given a chance to properly respond to those criticisms.
Let's go to Janine joining us from Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Janine.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. So I'm a human resources professional in Madison, Wisconsin, and I've been currently lobbying local legislation for mandatory harassment training in the workplace, at least 1 hour. And in addition to that, I have a daughter at Madison East High School, and there has been an assault there as well. And perhaps we should be looking at that in the school system as well.
Janine, how do you see companies and organizations like universities, dealing with harassment training? Are people watching videos? What are they doing to get information?
I think you can handle it a lot of ways. I think in-person training really solidifies the seriousness of it. But certainly, I know there are challenges and, multi-location employers. So I think just talking about it, much like safety, just having conversations and making people known that you're paying attention goes a long way.
Janine, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Cindy now in Mount Horeb. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Cindy.
Well, I was curious as to why Dr. Copper is being responsible or being held responsible for her husband's behavior.
Kelly, how would you answer that?
I would say that's a really good question, Cindy. You know, some people I've talked to about this case have said it's like Me Too kind of flipping itself on its head and making a woman accountable for a man's behavior that she wasn't involved in. I think the UW system's response would be the purpose of this investigation was to find out, you know, to what extent she knew of this and was involved in, you know, protecting him or whatnot. Yeah, that would probably be the system's response. I mean, I think Dr. Copper and her attorney, you know, would disagree and say that she's being unfairly held to account for something that she did not do.
Kelly, the UW-Whitewater is in a state of transition right now. The search is open for a new provost and a new chancellor, and other employees are leaving their positions. What are you hearing?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of turbulence on campus with a lot of turnover. Some people have attributed that to Dr. Copper's leadership and said people are leaving because they're unhappy with her. Her response would be people are leaving, they're getting promoted to other jobs, and that, you know, reflects highly on me that they're getting promoted. Yeah, but there's a lot of positions open, and there will be sort of a new chapter for UW-Whitewater in the coming months.
Moving over to UW-Stevens Point, last year an official there named Sean Wilson resigned after being accused of sexual harassment, and his job included handling sexual misconduct complaints, later hired as the interim assistant dean of students at UW-Eau Claire. Did this case change the way the UW system approached allegations at all?
Yes, they adopted a new policy requiring sexual harassment allegations to be documented in personnel files, and then for that information in those files to be passed along if a person applies to work at another UW campus or a different Wisconsin state agency during a prospective hiring process. So that's new, and that took effect in January, I believe.
And is that only within the UW system then, that documentation doesn't go perhaps across state lines to other university positions?
I asked about that. The UW system's response was it wasn't a requirement, but if the prospective employer does ask, they will provide that information on request.
Earlier this month, the UW system announced that it's joining this national effort to prevent sexual harassment in higher education. How does this collaboration work between multiple institutions?
That's a good question. You know, it was just announced, and I'm still trying to learn the details, but it sounds like they'll be working with a number of institutions and university systems across the country to look at best practices in addressing sexual harassment and sexual assault.
Well, you know, you've been watching higher ed for a while now. Have you seen institutions in general change their approach to how they communicate on campus about harassment in the workplace?
That's a good question. I think, yeah. I mean, I think after the Me Too movement began in late 2017, I think there's a lot more urgency from, you know, not just college campuses, but all workplaces in addressing this stuff and trying to keep workers informed of what's going on. At the same time, I think it's interesting that, you know, the UW system released this investigation, you know, on the afternoon of a holiday weekend, and they're declining to answer any more questions. So I've just, you know, resorted to submitting records requests for this. I think, you know, transparency is the best way to move forward in addressing these sorts of situations.
Let's go to Nancy now, joining us from Lodi. Nancy, hi.
Hi. So I have two questions. One question has to do with my daughter when she was one of our campuses. She was attacked, and when she reported it, she had to go through campus police. And I'm wondering if that has changed at all. She was, of course, victim shamed. It was, you know, brought on her, and I question whether it was to keep the statistics down for the campus or not.
Nancy, I want to pause right there because we are short on time for just a moment here. So campus police having jurisdiction on these investigations when someone comes forward and has a claim. Kelly, what do we know there?
I think, you know, students who are attacked on campus, they can report to campus police. I think they are allowed to report to regular police as well. You know, under Title IX, universities are required to report these sorts of situations to the federal government. So I don't know, you know, if there's intentional efforts to disguise these numbers or not, but that's sort of like an ongoing issue that higher education reporters are always trying to track and look at.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kelly Meyerhofer is a higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and we've been talking about this investigation at UW-Whitewater that found at least 7 students or staff claim they were sexually harassed by the husband of the former chancellor. Coming up, we welcome the mayors of Superior and Duluth as we explore the common bonds and the practical challenges that come with having a twin city. That's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we are live from our studios in Superior. So happy to be here. Superior, one of 2 cities referred to as the Twin Ports. Superior, Wisconsin, Duluth, Minnesota, they perch along the shore of Lake Superior as twin cities and seaports. And we're talking about bridging the relationship between each side of the bay. Do you work in Duluth but live in Superior, or is it the other way around? Tell us about your life traveling between these 2 towns or sticking to your own community. How have you seen the Twin Ports collaborate? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jim Payne is mayor of Superior, and he joins us here in our studios on the campus of UW-Superior. Mayor Payne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Emily Larson is mayor of Duluth, Minnesota, just across from Superior. Mayor Larson, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
In Wisconsin, I should say.
Yeah. Love it.
So I want to start, Mayor Payne, by clearing up something. When we say that Duluth and Superior are separated by something, that includes something watery, what is that watery thing?
Well, the official body of water is the St. Louis River estuary that is distinct from a river or a lake. And now Duluth has the pleasure of sitting on Lake Superior. Technically, Superior does not. We are only surrounded by the estuary. We have, since that estuary kind of goes even along Wisconsin Point, we don't really have any shoreline on the lake.
Well, now that we've cleared up the geography, made it official, how do you see the cities of Superior and Duluth working together for the good of the communities?
I think there's a lot of ways, but the first is recognizing that it's just one community. For the vast majority of our population, they really don't recognize those political or even ecological or geographic boundaries. This is one place that people frequently live in one place, work in another. They will live in one place, shop in another. It's one combined economy, and so that really makes us one place for the vast majority of people. And politically, it's important to recognize that. So it's something that it really just starts with relationships. I think we have to keep a close relationship with leaders on either side of the bridge.
Mayor Larson, what project can you point to that's really shown how the two cities collaborate, or what has happened where you've seen the two cities pull together?
Yeah, Well, as Mayor Payne mentioned, you know, the fact that we share this incredible geography, we have really partnered strongly in support of the St. Louis River and the estuary and the cleanup and the remediation there. I think that's very palpable. I know from talking with residents and listening with them that our partnership and support of issues that are important to both of us and our residents have really been important. So whether it is us speaking up in support of programs that you know, lift up women who have experienced domestic violence or sexual trauma, whether it is working in support of sister cities and global relationships, whether it is lifting up the arts in our community. I know that those there are sometimes kind of smaller gestures because they're not necessarily broadest political impact or policy impact, but very, very meaningful for people to see that these two mayors are, you know, stepping up and leading in partnership with one another, not one behind the other, but really side by side.
So how do you see, Mayor Larson, the Twin Ports connected economically?
Mm-hmm. Well, we share several industries, actually. We are an international shipping port, which I think is such a huge lifeblood for both of our communities. So we are shipping around the world. We are a conduit for connecting in Minnesota, the Iron Range, and all of those economies. For us, you know, the MSA of Duluth and Superior is really substantial, both in terms of population and geography. But if you distill into different sectors, there's a strong manufacturing, there's a huge higher ed, regional healthcare factor. But there's also the creative arts, which really in Duluth and Superior is amazing. We have, you know, a ballet, a symphony, week-long music festival, all sorts of things that you really don't find in communities of our size typically. I think we live in an area that is feeling very inspired and connected, very democracy-rich, very engaged. And so that really gets reflected in how people, you know, show up and demonstrate that.
Mayor Payne, what does Superior gain by being part of a larger economic community? Because you're the smaller piece here, right?
Well, yeah, we're the smaller city, but you know, I want to point to about a year ago on this campus, we conducted some listening sessions for demographics across the city of Superior. And one of the things that came up over and over again was people appreciated living in a small city and feeling like they lived in a small city, almost a small town, but having access to a larger metropolitan area. So to have that resource, especially as Mayor Larson pointed out, culturally, the ability to go and experience a larger urban area is very important for a lot of the people that live here.
We're talking with Jim Payne, the mayor of Superior, Wisconsin, and Emily Larson, the mayor of Duluth, Minnesota. You can join in if you live in a twin city, as the Twin Ports are. Do you live in Superior or Duluth? Maybe you have a family living here or visit often. What differences do you see between the two communities? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mayor Larson, let's look a little bit on those differences. Where do you see the Twin Ports different?
Duluth and Superior really have a lot of similarities. We share a lot of interests. We share a lot of people. We do have really distinct differences that I think are actually really positive for each of us. The city of Duluth is really a regional center, really, for the entire northern part of Minnesota. We have some very distinct differences as it relates to our state politics, as it relates to some of the tools that we have that we can draw upon, different rules that we can leverage. Our forms of government are somewhat different. I think, again, one is not better than the other. Both are fully representative of the intent of the community. I do think that there are sometimes, you know, we have different bases of activation sometimes. You know, we do live in this time in which people want to feel very closely connected to local government. They are residents find and see and feel and should, you know, demand action on local level because there tends to be gridlock on the state and federal level or frustrations around that. And so I do see that showing itself differently in our communities as well. And yet many of the things that have made each of our cities strong continues to be there. Very strong labor communities, very strong histories of resource extraction, very strong histories of environmental protection. We exemplify that somewhat differently in our communities, but one of the things I have found so refreshing, I think, Jim, is this maybe our third year working together?
Yeah, we're entering a third year. Yeah.
And really, within 6 months of working alongside Mayor Payne, we had already done more together than what we were able to establish Duluth and Superior in the year and a half prior. So, you know, there is just something about being available, being active, reaching out to one another and our communities and staying deeply connected that while there are significant differences, it's like it's so great. It's so great. You know, it's so wonderful to have one strong city. It's even better to have two.
Let's go to Mary Ann now, joining us from Superior. Hi, Mary Ann.
Good morning. The reason that I'm calling in, I've been a Superiorite for almost all of my life, and what I've been noticing this last year or so is the strong business community that's coming up along Tower Avenue, our main street, and so many businesses are started by women, and I find that to be extremely exciting. Also, we have a new hotel that's going to be beginning on sometime in August, right on our main street, so that's going to really infuse our business community. And then the last thing is how many young people that I'm meeting, young couples that have decided to make Superior their home. They work in Duluth, and the one comment I hear is it's only a bridge that separates us. So this is an exciting time for Superior, Wisconsin.
Mary Ann, thank you so much for calling in.
Great.
Yeah, Mayor Payne, how would you respond?
Well, that's always a great first call. Thanks, Mary Ann. No, what she's describing is, in kind of technical terms, urbanism, the idea that we can revitalize areas by focusing on a sense of place. And that's actually something I learned from this partnership years before I was mayor. One of the real incarnations of this partnership is our Metropolitan Interstate Council, which combines municipalities across the Twin Ports region, not just Duluth and Superior, to talk about transportation. And a lot of those planners started focusing on a lot of this placemaking that you're seeing in both Duluth and Superior now that Mary Ann is talking about, including the Tower Avenue rebuild. And now we're starting to bleed that into other areas, but it's really improving quality of life for a lot of our people. And I think I really appreciate hearing from people like Mary Ann that this is an expression of our values. It's not just
That's
about
right.
beautification. This is about coming together as a community. And I especially like hearing her talk about a lot of the women-owned businesses mm-hmm. that are coming up. We have to do more to celebrate and incentivize people that are historically disenfranchised to become entrepreneurs, to help make that step to really grow our community.
Do you see young people moving in to Superior, or do you watch trends like that?
Yes, moving in and moving up.
And what do you mean by moving up?
But they're not just coming in and looking for that job and settling down. They're looking for ways to grow the community as well through involvement in community organizations, to becoming entrepreneurs and actually open businesses and change the community. You see that across the Twin Ports. It really does not look like the 1980s here. Everybody is involved. You don't have to wait until you're an executive in your company before you become a senior member of the community. We're seeing people in college or in their early 20s start to become leaders in this community.
We're talking about what it means to be a neighboring city as we broadcast from our studios in Superior with neighbor Duluth just across the bay. Duluth Mayor Emily Larson and Superior Mayor Jim Payne, stay with us. How have you seen the Twin Ports work together? What do you think makes this partnership unique? What do you think makes these places similar? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring what it means to be a twin city as the morning show comes to you from Superior. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Duluth forms a metro area with her neighbor Superior, and together they're called the Twin Ports, and the cities share the Duluth-Superior Harbor, and together are the Great Lakes' largest port And this got us thinking about what it's like to live and work in a twin city. Do you live in a city with another community just across the river or across a dividing line? Maybe you grew up with a city just across the Mississippi, like Minneapolis-St. Paul. What's it like? How does your town work across a border? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The mayors of Duluth and Superior stay with us. Emily Larson on the Minnesota side. Jim Payne on the Wisconsin side. We have Tim from Shell Lake who called in to say, if it wasn't for the easy access from Duluth to Superior to get to the hospital, Tim says he wouldn't be alive today. It was easy to get access, and that connection between the cities helps a lot of people in rural northern and northwestern Wisconsin. Mayor Larson, can you talk a little bit about transportation and infrastructure between these cities?
Oh, my gosh. I can talk about infrastructure a lot and potholes and all sorts of other great things. Yeah, actually, what's interesting about his comment is it does mirror Marianne's earlier, which is that you can see a bridge as being a dividing tool or you can see it as being a point of connection. And so that is one of the things that we really that we heavily invest in, which is transportation infrastructure and how to ensure that people are moving around safely and having those, you know, efficient connections in the case of this writer just now. So actually, you know, Mayor Payne and I share these two really significant connection points of bridges that at different times carry literally hundreds of thousands of people every day. And so not only is that a local transportation and infrastructure issue, but that is also around MnDOT and WizDOT and all of those elements. It's really important that government provide that kind of stability around which you can, you know, just plan to have not just your basic needs met, but also access to emergency services when you need them, and that you can show up and get there, and that we are just getting the stuff done so that your life can be, you know, all yours. And
yeah, how does that work with municipal things like fire, you know, fire service, fire trucks, for instance, and calls like that? Do you cross state lines?
Yeah, you know, our teams work very closely together. And I know Mayor Payne, you know, we can talk about an emergency situation that we've experienced as a community that really requires us to step up as one community. So we have literally emergency plans as it relates to different natural disasters, man-made disasters that our teams consult with one another, work together. We have a command center when there is a weather-related event or an emergency. And so, yeah, there's it's part of what we have invested in as municipalities is not just the singular experience of being within one city, but it is how do we make this the fluidity of being in one city and engaging with another be safe and reliable, and really investing in the communication channels to make that possible. So
Mayor Payne, I'll let you step into this one first.
Yeah, of course. The when it comes to protecting the community, that's something that we absolutely have to have a partnership on. And that's a longstanding partnership between our two communities to make sure that we're providing police and fire for the whole community. Those bridges, it's easy to take them for granted, but they are very, very significant infrastructure projects. And we feel it pretty acutely when one of them has to close for one reason or another. The community is already connected. So it's our job to make sure it stays physically connected. But when it comes to public safety, it's worth recognizing that while we assist one another with the individual with the emergencies in each individual city, there are a lot of things that we have to protect together. The port is one of the those biggest things. That's our port that we share, and it's one thing. There's not a Duluth port and a Superior port. It's one harbor, as you mentioned. And so that partnership is absolutely vital, as it is with any neighboring community. But that physical divide does make it a little bit more challenging.
And we're coming up here on the one-year anniversary of the Husky Refinery disaster. What have you learned about communication in the wake of that fire?
That's kind of the story here in the one-year anniversary of it is communication. I think there were a lot of things we did very well when it came to communicating with the public. But we knew even that day that it was the most important thing we could do. You know, we had professionals responding to the emergency, but the public was a very big part of that day. They were very deeply impacted by this. And so we focus a lot in the aftermath on how we communicate with the public in the event of an emergency, not just giving out correct information, but combating incorrect information, which continues to be a challenge.
Go ahead, Mary Larson.
Yeah, no, I think what's interesting about that, no one really wants to experience that kind of emergency. That's scary and really shakes people to their core. You know, Mayor Payne and I and our teams communicated really well. I actually think our teams had excellent response. I will be very pointed in saying that the response of the Husky team and the refinery was very disappointing. I am frustrated with the choices they continue to make and how they want to operate their refinery. We have been very pointed in that. Mayor Payne and I have shared messaging on that. We have also found our own ways to work with the company and the refinery to communicate the concerns of our residents and our citizens. It is an ongoing issue, and of course, the safety board has asked for a review of the HF that they are using there, so it's a story that continues to evolve. And I think, actually, that example of that refinery is both a wonderful example of how our communities worked very closely in collaboration and yet also retained our own identities. You know, when that happens, it's really important for me to not jump in as a mayor and kind of take the messaging over. This is happening in Superior. There are a lot of things that I need to not be deferential about, but be very respectful of kind of the municipal territory, while also, you know, concurrently doing what I need to do to assure safety and preparedness on our side of the bridge. So it was a really good example of how to do that, do it well, do it efficiently, and then in, you know, the day after and further after, how do our communities define themselves individually in their communication? And even though Jim and I have not shared every piece of communication in as shared mayors on that, we have remained in communication ourselves to say, hey, here's what I'm thinking, here's what I'm doing. And so there is also something about making sure the other is not surprised when you're dealing with these really, really big issues.
Now, we'll be having a full show tomorrow, 1 year later after Husky. Good. But I'm wondering, do you feel like the communication lines are open still and very clear with Husky and the refinery and what is happening there, Mayor Payne?
Yeah, we communicate with the refinery, but there isn't always a lot of dialogue. The refinery makes decisions. They don't have discussions and debate. And that is, well, actually, I should say the company. It's important to distinguish the refinery from the company because on the day of the fire, the refinery responded very well. The emergency response teams and the people in charge of the refinery met that disaster very, very effectively. But the company is making decisions about the rebuild, particularly in the way that they refine gasoline with the use of hydrogen fluoride. And while they are hearing a great deal of feedback from the community, it's not clear to me that they're taking that feedback in meaningfully. Particularly, they're not giving us a lot of the information that we're asking for, or they're not recognizing That's right. the fact that there's not unbiased third-party information to weigh in on this subject. And so they're just kind of asking us to take them at their word. Now, that's not to say everything they're doing is wrong. Yes, they're making some meaningful safety improvements, but that's not what the community is asking for. The community is asking for them to make a change. And I think as grateful as we are that they listen, listening is only the first step. There has to be action following that.
Well, we have just a few moments left here, but I wanted to ask you, what's next for Duluth and Superior? Where do you see the next place that these the Twin Ports can come together, Mayor Larson?
Yeah, well, a couple weeks ago, I gave my State of the City, and I know Mayor Payne gives his on Monday, and I would envision that there is some overlap in what we see as priority areas for our community. For me, it's affordable housing. It's continuing to push our success in energy-related investments and decreasing greenhouse gases. It is a variety of connections and ensuring health and safety in our community. I think those are all areas that we can really get a lot of collaborative work done.
Along with improving our relationship with Lake Superior. I think that's something that's important to everybody. I'd like to throw in about the lake.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Jim Payne is mayor of Superior, Wisconsin. Emily Larson is the mayor of Duluth, Minnesota. Still ahead from our WPR studios in Superior, we're headed to Mars with rocket scientist Robert Zubrin as our guide. You're with us here on the Ideas Network.